Well, good afternoon. Welcome after lunch. I'm going to talk about observations, sort of a general, more general talk. I've been interested in us as observers, and I've written a few things that are on this Soils website, soils.wisc.edu, and there's a few references there. And then I'm currently participating in a blog at bridgesofunity.com. So there's a little more information there on some of what I was going to say today. But what I wanted to deal with here is observations. I mean, we all know observations are the backbone of science, and we tend to think of them as instruments, to extend our senses, as measurements, which use the instrument the right way, and as models for interpretation in order to get meaning from deductive, inductive, abductive reasoning. You probably all know what deductive and inductive are. Abductive is the basis for measurement, the reasoning that we use to do measurements. We also know the scientific method, that's part of observation, but we know that we don't actually do it this way. This is the way we write it up, so it looks like we do it this way, but we all know we don't actually. So I'm not going to talk about that part. I'm going to talk about us, that is the human observer. Most critical part of any observation. I mean, we're the rule makers, right? We're the ones who have the authority in science. We're the ones who decide things. But we have sort of arbitrarily decided that as observers, we're outside of what we're observing. And so we're external consciousness business. Our awareness is external to the observation. That is a big assumption. And we think we can assume it because we think the observer effect is neutralized by peer review or by independent observations by another person. But it actually doesn't, we don't actually quite work this way. We're a little more complicated than some kind of a machine like that. So my objective is to try to give you a perspective on considering the human observer in a more direct way, how we influence what we do. And I think there should be equal level of interest to the instrument, to the measurement, and to the model or interpretation process that we go through. And so I'm going beyond this whole issue of ethics. We all know that ethics in our behavior is pretty important, but that's decided outside of science anyway. Courts decide that. And so I'm more interested in us dealing with our awareness. I mean, how do we function? How does our consciousness work? And how does it influence the measurements that we do or the observations that we do? Now here's a quote. Observations not only disturb what is measured, they produce it. This guy, Ernst Pascal Jordan, is a very famous physicist. Right? He worked with Max Born, who got the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1954, and he probably would have shared that prize with Max Born if he hadn't joined the Nazi Party during the Second World War, and so he became unpopular for that reason. But this is a hardcore physicist, all right? Worked in quantum mechanics and field theory and matrix mechanics, and a lot of the early physicists had to struggle with this whole issue of consciousness. I mean, how they were influencing the measurements that they were making, they knew it. Now, we've been happy to assume that quantum mechanics happens down there at this little tiny particle level, and it doesn't really work its way all the way up to us. Right? We're the macro scale, they're the micro scale, things are different there. That's another unstated assumption. I mean, they might not be different there. We know that we got bias, and we got different kinds of bias. That's inherent in human observation. So I want to read you something I came across about how we actually work. Human perception occurs by a complex, unconscious process of abstraction in which certain details of the incoming sense data are noticed and remembered, and the rest is forgotten. Right? What's kept and what is thrown away depends on an internal model, a representation of the world that psychologists call a schema, and it's built up over our entire lives based on our experiences. So the data that we take is fit into this schema. And the importance of various perceived data depends on the internal value system. And the memory gaps might be filled by plausible data The mind makes up to fit the model. And when you come back and withdraw these things from your memory, you can't tell the difference between what you actually observe and what your mind made up in order to fit the pieces together, because that's what your mind does. It fits the pieces together. And it fits them together in a way that's consistent with your experience. Well, when you realize this, you have to be a little concerned if you want to be exploring truth or something that's of more general value than your own opinion, if this is the way you're functioning. Now, sometimes it's a little hard to admit this. But we know about the biases. We have this confirmation bias, pathological science, happened in biology and Europe in the Second World War. We got a processing bias when data is processed in the instrument and we never see the raw data. All we see is something that's already processed and might have some bias in it. But the observational bias is the one I like best. This is when we look where we think we're going to find positive results. Because we know 80% of the positive results get published and 80% of the negative results get rejected. So this is a bias we all have inherently in us. It's called the streetlight effect, right? We look, we record the data where it's easiest to measure it. I mean, those are all biases introduced in here. So what's our traditional view? The observer is outside of the domain of science. A little strange, but that's how we operate. It goes back 400 plus years to René Descartes. He's a phenomenal philosopher, mathematician. He's the one who created the Cartesian coordinate system. I mean, he's an incredible guy. He's the one who said, I think, therefore I am. Right? And we like that. And it's this is a something in modern science we've interpreted as the observer is independent of the observation. So I call this to-i-i-o-to, okay? A little acronym. So when you see to-i-i-o-to in this presentation, it means the observer is independent of the observation. Right? Now this has worked pretty well for 400 years. I mean, we've been working under this assumption and we've managed to unravel a whole lot of mysteries about life. But not all of them. And we got some pretty strong struggles. Trouble is brewing. Here's a quote from one of the most famous philosophers of the 20th century. More than anything else, the future of civilization depends on the way the two most powerful forces of history, science and religion, and I stick mysticism in here, it's a little more general than religion, settle into relationship with each other. So if when we start to consider the observer, we're moving into this sort of no man's land between science and mysticism. Right? And makes us a little nervous as scientists, because we become comfortable with just accepting the observers on the outside. But this to-i-i-o-to assumption ignores the reality of collective human communication and behavior. Because we behave in groups, we don't behave individually. Right? I prefer to say, I am, therefore I think. This little difference between shifting this simple little phrase is a profound impact. I mean, if you accept it. If I accept that I am, then the observer starts to become important. So I'm going to suggest the observer is experiencing. Experiencing is consciousness. And consciousness is this sensory stimulation, thoughts, feelings, and memory. So these issues are crucial. I want to digress just for a moment here into neuroscience. This is a new field that has really kind of revolutionized the way we think about how we function. You know, a lot of fascinating stuff. You might wonder how it relates to soil science or science itself. I'll show you. So the prevailing hypothesis is thoughts and illusion that's created by electrochemistry in the brain. And by far the majority of neuroscientists subscribe to this hypothesis. It's an assumption. There's no evidence for this, but it's a reasonable working assumption. The second hypothesis is that thought originates in the mind, which is external to the brain. It's a very tiny fraction of neuroscientists believe this. Now, the first hypothesis is an assumption. The second one is based on observations of OCD patients. OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. So we know from genetics that experience modifies gene expression. The whole field of science of genetics called epigenetics. And it's a powerful new field, a lot of controversy. Geneticists are struggling with this because clearly thought changes genes. Which genes are expressed, which genes are not expressed. It doesn't change the underlying strand, the DNA, it changes the little segments we call genes. And there's a neat article in the Discover magazine, you can read about this, and I've written some things about it in this Bridges of Unity site that you could read if you feel like it. But a lot of this work is based on Schwartz and Baxter, who worked in the lab, and they found that really the only logical conclusion of their outcome of their experiments was that the mind exists, and it's separate from the brain. Because these OCD patients could rewire their brain, they could change the path that the information moved down, the neuron connections, with only their thoughts. And those changes were at least as effective as the best pharmaceuticals for treating OCD. So this caused a lot of controversy, and there's a certain amount of, academic freedom taken in connecting this to free will and such things. That's really created a stir in the community. But you can read about it in this Discover article, or you can read about it in Schwartz's book, You Are Not Your Brain. But this guy, Richard Davidson, is really a pioneer in this area. And he's worked a lot with it. And he implies in his recent book, The Emotional Life of Your Brain, that the mind is separate from the brain, but he doesn't ever actually say it. You can't find that statement in there. Davidson worked with meditating monks and the Dalai Lama over many years, and there's a fascinating article in the most recent Scientific American, and the first author, Ricard, here is a monk, actually. Lutz and Davidson are neuroscientists. And they work with different kinds of meditation. What's important here is if you look down here at the blue data versus the orange data, the blue data is for the meditators, the orange data is for the controls, and these are the size of different portions of your brain. The insula versus the Brodmann areas 9 and 10, you can see that meditators are increasing the size of their brain. They're changing their physiology and anatomy of their brains with this mental practice. Here's another quote from a physicist that's probably one of the most prominent physicists of the 20th century, Max Planck. Yeah, I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as a derivative of consciousness. If you believe this, you can hardly assume the observer is independent of the observation. We cannot get behind consciousness. Everything that we talk about, everything we regard as existing postulates consciousness. Or Nikola Tesla, you probably all know the name Tesla. The day science begins to study non-physical phenomena, it will make more progress in one decade than in the previous centuries of its existence. So there's a lot of reason we should be opening ourselves up to this possibility. Now, I can tell by the look on your faces, I'm not doing a very good job of convincing you. That doesn't surprise me, okay? I'm not surprised by your look, but I'm still going to keep poking you, all right? Not going to stop me from poking you. Now, so what good is it to talk about consciousness if we don't have any tools to study it? Well, there is a tool that has emerged, but it's largely ignored. This guy David Hawkins, published a book, Power versus Force, in about 1995. The latest edition is 2012. And he describes methodologies from behavioral kinesiology that relate to choices a person can make. So he worked for 20 years in a laboratory test, standard statistical test in laboratory environments, and he worked with a yes-no response of manual muscle testing. Right? And he regarded the results of this testing as aspects of consciousness itself, all right? Something deeper than your thoughts, completely independent of a test subject's belief systems, intellectual opinions, reason, or logic. It's basically saying that your muscle system is connected into your consciousness in a different way than your mind is. And that we can use that to learn something about our consciousness. It's been used in alternative medicine for 50 years. Right? It's an old practice. Now this could be useful in science. Think about it. I mean, if you're making choices for ideas for proposals, if you're trying to resolve problems in an experiment, if you want to know something about your own integrity or the integrity of someone else who wants to know their own integrity, this might be a useful tool. But it has limitations. And he outlines them in detail in this book. It takes a lot of practice. It's got limitations. It requires two people with neutral intention. Neutral intention. The intentions of the people involved in this affect the outcome, right? But it's quick and easy. Once you perfect it, you can use it very, very easily. It's powerful. So he set up a scale, consciousness scale, ranges from 0 to 1,000, quantitative scale. And he sets two thresholds in this scale as calibration points on this scale. And then he's going to relate this quantitative scale to a qualitative scale of consciousness, right? That is a scale that we're going to use, we're going to talk about in terms of words, right? And here's the words he puts onto this scale. And you'll notice that the words on the left side mostly refer to emotions. The words in the middle between the two thresholds mostly refer to thought. And the words on the right of the right threshold deal more with being. And so he's got this full scale of consciousness. And all of us can operate in different places on the scale at different times under different circumstances. But there is a characteristic that each one of us has that we fall into when we're threatened or when we're dealing with uncertainty or some kind of a challenge that we aren't sure that we're up to. We have a pattern that we have. Now, if you're below this level 200 here, or if you're on the left, to the left of it, this whole manual muscle testing doesn't work because you don't have enough integrity in your intention to get that whole thing to work. So it becomes important to know where you are on this scale. Well, when I first started messing with this, I wasn't sure I really wanted to know where I was, right? Maybe I don't have as much integrity as I'd like to assume I have. But it's still worth doing. I can tell you, it's still worth doing. So on the left side of the scale, it's motivation by doing. The middle is motivation by becoming. The right is motivation by being. Right? The context of the ones on the left is more about survival, reward systems, making enough money, all of these kinds of things. The center is questioning. Becoming, learning becomes a bigger motivation for people. And then the right, the context is love, but it's a bigger definition of love here. There's more limitations of possibilities on the left side, and less limitation of human possibilities on the right side. You expand your possibilities, because a person can operate easily at all levels of consciousness below their normal level of consciousness. And frequently do. So you have ego dominance and mind intelligence on the left. You have more heart dominance, heart intelligence on the right. Now this has been mostly rejected by scientists, okay? It's not verified by standard hypothesis testing. But hypothesis testing often comes with a bias. This to-i-i-o-to assumption that we're happy to make is it actually often involves a bias because you want to prove something true or false, right? If you're willing to assume that the observer is not independent of the observation, then your intention matters, right? Your intention matters a lot. So you have to deal with consciousness if you're going to question this to-i-i-o-to assumption. So if you're living under that assumption, which we all do in science, then you're happy to ignore the intention of the observer, whether it's biased or not, because it'll come out in the wash anyway. But if you're not sure about whether the observer is independent of the observation, then prejudging an outcome is bias, right? And it's not acceptable, right? So you quickly are going to end up below this threshold of utility, right? If you start out with bias. So you realize that if we start to consider this, we have to really revisit our own integrity and how we're doing what we're doing. This is a big challenge, huge, huge challenge. But building a $10 billion collider in Geneva is a big challenge too, and we could do that. So I'll wind up with this quote from Eben Alexander, who's a neurosurgeon who went from a materialist to a mystic, I suppose you'd call him, in a week. And you can read this. It's pretty insightful comment that he makes in the book that he's published. And I'll return to Nikola Tesla's comment on how important it is for us to face the reality of our own self-awareness and encourage us to begin to explore this. Can't take it all on at one time, but we could begin. So with that, thank you for your attention. Thank you for not throwing me out. Pleased to be here.
We have time for one question. John?
Thanks, John. I really enjoyed your talk. Thanks for all these stimulating ideas. And one thing I think your talk as a whole makes a great point of, well, you don't have an observation unless you're applying some preconception, some model to the instrumented sensory perception. But I would just point out that the other way is true. You don't have an observation if you just have a model without any sensory input. So that's, I guess, not so much a question as a plug for, well,
our awareness is a pretty important part of what we do. And ignoring it doesn't mean that its effect is going to go away. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Yeah.